This is Lynn Fox for the Thorn and Hatfield Oral History Project. It's the 7th of July 2006, and I'm talking to Mr. Jeff Trinder, who is the chair, is it?
The chairman of the Isle Group of the Lincolnshire Wildlife Trust.
Morning, Mr. Trinder. I wonder if we could start maybe with just saying a few words about how you came to be in this area and how you started your interest in the wildlife of the area, but primarily, how did you come to be here in this area?
Well, we lived in Bridlington, and my stepfather got a job at Kidby Power Station when it was being built as a storeman, and so obviously, you know, couldn't travel from Bridlington, so we actually moved to Scunthorpe. And then, having gone away to college, I came back to Scunthorpe and got a job teaching art at Epworth Secondary Modern School, as it was then, South Axome Comprehensive, it became. It's now got another name, which I can't remember at the time. But so, consequently, I eventually came to live in the Isle when I got married.
Mm-hmm. And you obviously have an interest in wildlife. How did that start?
I don't know how it started, but I've always been fascinated by creatures and the natural world. I was one of those revolting kids who kept all this manner of animals over the years. You know, I had mice in my pocket, which revolts me at the thought of it now. I suppose I've kept most things during my life, including breeding snakes and other reptiles at one stage. And initially it was birds that interested me in the outside world. And shouldn't say this today, but I used to collect eggs. But in those days it was a healthy pursuit. I think I even got a badge for doing it in the Scouts. Obviously not acceptable anymore. And I met a gentleman called Joe Duddington, who was on a wild place just outside Scunthorpe. I was looking for bird's nests, and he was actually recording moths and butterflies, and he interested me in that side. And sort of gradually my interest developed and encompassed more than just birds. Thanks to Joe, it was insects, and then later became interested in plants as well. So really a general interest in wildlife, but birds was the sort of starting point as such.
Where did you actually live when you were a child?
I started off, I was born in Tyneside, and then I can't tell you all the places, but we moved around an awful lot due to my father's work. He was actually a professional photographer, and among other places, Leeds, Wakefield, and eventually ended up in Bridlington before moving to Scunthorpe. Mm.
And you actually lived in Scunthorpe in the town?
Yes, in the town itself, yeah.
Were you aware at that time of the landscape around you?
Well, yeah, I mean, Scunthorpe then, there were all sorts of places where I used to go. I mean, in my early teens and right through till sort of 16 or so, I'd get on my bike and you know, off into the countryside. Where we lived, actually, you could only have to go half a mile and you were almost in open country. It's now all building sites or you know, there was an area called, what was it called, the Floods, I think it was called, which is now all industrial site down adjoining the steelworks, where John Leggett College is now. That was a lovely wild area. Used to go there searching for butterflies, the large hedgerows, and now it's reading for states and all the rest of it. So, in fact, there were lots of areas within walking distance, let alone cycling distance, of where I lived, so fairly close to the outskirts of Scunthorpe. But with industrial and you know, need for housing, those have all disappeared.
And did you know about the moors at that time?
No, I didn't know about the moors till Joe actually brought me out to Epworth Turbary, which I've managed for the Trust for the last 30 years. And probably then was sort of vaguely aware there were other places within the Isle, but Epworth Turbary was where we went to do collecting and recording of moths particularly. We went out with a tilly lamp and a white sheet in those days and you know, would stay out there and see how many moths we could record.
Can you tell me how that works?
Well, moths can be attracted to light. And in the early days, before I had mercury vapour lights, which is used now for trapping moths, you basically had a tilly lamp which you pumped up and you laid a white sheet on the ground and you put the tilly lamp in the middle and you sat back and you waited and the moths would come and land on the sheet. And then you would catch them in little boxes, identify them and keep lists, and in those days, again, collect them. Not in huge numbers, but you would build up a collection of them. The important thing was each one you collected must have on it a little label underneath stating when it was caught, where it was caught, the locality, the county, who it was caught by, and whether it was caught as an adult insect or found as a caterpillar or as a pupa, because if you didn't have those details, then scientifically it was of no value whatsoever. So it was important to record all those things so that you had a genuine record, historical record of where it occurred.
So when you've got them on your sheet and then you put them into a box, yeah, which must have been fairly easy to do, and then what did you do with them?
Well, you would kill them. In my case, so thinking about it now, I used to have a cyanide jar in my teens, which I used to carry in a rucksack on my back. And that was a cyanide pellet, well, a layer of plaster of Paris, layer of cyanide pellets, and then a layer of plaster of Paris which was set on top, and a screw top jar, and the fumes actually killed the insect. Today you wouldn't obviously be allowed to do it.
But so you put the
moth inside, tipped it in, put the lid on, and the moth like that, so almost instantaneous. And you made sure you didn't take a breath as well at the same time. So that was the way I used to use and kill them. And then you would set them on a board, special board with a groove down the middle, a pin through the thorax, you put the body in the groove, and then you very carefully spread the wings out and hold them down with special tape and leave them for 2-3 weeks till they set. Having put a note at the side where they were caught, etc. And then all the details would be put on a little note that big on the underside of the pin underneath the moth or the butterfly, so you could lift it up and see all the details. Which is one of the reasons I probably have to wear glasses now, because I used to write all these labels out with a mapping pen. Spend hours doing that. So, that was one way. The other way to catch moths is actually to use sugar, which is a mixture of all sorts of things like black treacle, a little drop of rum and brown sugar. You boil it all together into a sticky mixture. And this is better in the autumn, actually, when there aren't many flowers around. And you paint it on tree trunks. And again, you just wander around, on a regular route, see what moths have arrived. And if you want one, you just tap it on the head, it falls in the box. Sort of fairly intoxicated, and that's what we always felt, because of a little bit of rum. And you couldn't kill those for 24 hours, because if you did, they would turn greasy. You had to wait for what they'd eaten, the sugar and things, to pass through their system before you killed them. And then say you would kill them after 24 hours, so the food had all gone through.
So were they just sort of dopey on this?
You could just literally put the little pill box underneath them, tap on the head, and they used to fall in. And that was sort of in more mature woodlands. I didn't do that so much on Epworth, although we did do it a little bit, but did it in Lawton Forest, for example.
And the ones that you killed, all the ones you killed, actually, but the ones you killed with cyanide, did you have to do anything else to preserve them, or did they...?
No, you killed them, then you had to actually leave them for 24 hours because rigor mortis set in, but after 24 hours they would relax, and then you would set them. And then after they had this period of drying and becoming rigid again, you put them in an airtight box. The first thing I ever bought when I started teaching was a Victorian insect cabinet. Cost me £50. I mean, then I was only paid £32 a month. First 2-3 months' wages just went on that. And the glass topped, like having museums where they keep insects. So that was one of the first things I ever bought. Purely to sort of keep the collection in.
And you gathered your own collection, did you?
Yeah. With Joe, we both used to collect.
Can I ask you why?
Good question, that, actually. Why do people climb mountains? Because it's there. I think my generation, kids were more tuned in to the natural world. I mean, we knew when the conkers were ready. We knew when the frog spawn was there. And we were allowed to go out, we weren't sort of kept in worries about being somebody absconding with you or anything like that. We have a lot more freedom than children today have. So, we'd go out, we'd find conkers, we'd go out into wild areas and play cowboys and Indians and what have you. We knew when the frog, we'd go and collect frog spawn, keep it in a jar. Most of it died, sadly, but, you were just aware of it more because you were given this freedom to wander around. And it was a natural possession, progression then, to sort of collect things. I know David Attenborough had been interviewed years ago on television, when he was asked what was one of the saddest things. He said, people can't collect anymore because these things are so scarce now. And, his generation, a little bit slightly older than mine, that's how we did things in those days. If you were interested, yes, you collected. I collected birds' eggs initially, then butterflies and moths. Some people pressed wildflowers. Nowadays, of course, you take photographs instead, which is what I do today.
And did you know other people that did it? the same thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's one or two friends who collected moths, and obviously some of Joe's friends were basically interested. The thing is, it's difficult to imagine now, but I used to go bird watching and had a pair of binoculars, but you didn't really want people to see you walking around with binoculars because we were, shall we say, regarded as slightly eccentric. Whereas, I mean, today, bird watchers, you know, they're all over the place, telescopes sticking out all that everywhere. But it was quite a new thing. There weren't that many people had the interest in natural history that they did today, that they do today. So it's developed over the last, 50 years quite considerably, but I mean, particularly bird watching, more so than probably the other branches. So, I mean, I had a butterfly net, and again, you didn't sort of wander around with a butterfly net. I had a folding one, which you put in my pocket, because, again, if you'd been seen wandering around with a butterfly net, people would have probably wanted to lock you up. It was a very strange thing to do. It was the sort of thing that vicars' daughters and vicars used to be in the leading light among naturalists in those days as well. So...
I was just wondering whether it was something you did with Joe and made your own collection, but had contact with other people and sort of made a general collection.
Not that many people. I mean, Joe had his own collection, I had mine. And once I met Joe, I didn't collect any more birds' eggs. But no, Joe was the main figure. I mean, my father, stepfather, he'd had a collection of bird eggs years before, and he'd actually got a collection of tropical butterflies, which... I'm not sure where he acquired those. I think he had a relative who'd been out in the tropics. So, you know, that there'd been that interest from that side as well. And my father initially also, my real father, he'd sort of always kept animals. And, you know, we had dogs and all sorts of things. So it was just, I'd always been surrounded by creatures of one sort or another. I mean, we had Afghan hounds, rabbits, you name it. We've kept it, basically.
So it was a personal collection, it wasn't...
Oh, it was a personal collection, yeah, definitely, yeah, mm-hmm. Yes.
And do you still have it?
No. I think about 3 years ago, I bought the cabinet from Watkins and Doncaster, and I sold the whole lot back to them because I now do photography, and I travel worldwide, not just in this country. And it was sitting in a corner of the cabinet and basically not being used, not being looked at. And I thought, well, if, you know, Watkins and Doncaster will buy it off me, then somebody else can make use of it rather than just gathering dust and deteriorating, because it does need upkeep. You've got to put the camphor in to keep mites out and what have you. So, you know, I decided, right, let it go and concentrate on the photography.
So you have this, you're collecting moths with Joe.
Yeah.
You have this collection. Was that the main thing you were interested in? Well, that's the main thing you were interested in, but was there other things?
Well, birds initially, but Joe, I say, introduced me to butterflies and moths. And for my teens, and probably early 20s, that was the thing that was, I won't say all-encompassing, but that took precedent, if you like, because we used to go out quite regularly. It was something you could do. I'd say birds' eggs, you didn't collect birds' eggs anymore. It got to the stage where it was, you know, not the thing to do and became illegal. So, yes, most of my efforts were put into looking for butterflies and moths.
Was collecting birds' eggs something that people continued into adult life?
Oh, there were, yes. But, I mean, there are still, obviously, the main egg collectors that are around today, so are adults. But, I mean, lots of kids collected birds' eggs when I was a child. Some would have continued into adulthood. But, say, at the time when I was sort of, 12, 13, 14, 15, it was then that it became something that was, you know, illegal. I can't remember the date it was actually made totally illegal. It's so that phase went and butterflies and moths, you know, took over basically for a period.
Mm-hmm. And what came after that?
Courting and marriage and children, basically. But I had joined the trust in the meantime due to Joe, and we got the newsletter pops through every whatever it was, 2-3 times a year, and I didn't think an awful lot about it. And I can't remember exactly how it started. Oh, yes, I can. It started again. I was head of the evening centre at Epworth. Chris, my wife, was at home looking after the children, and I took over running the evening centre as well as the day job. And... There was a course on natural history, and a couple of people came along to this, and they got some photographs of birds they'd taken, and that immediately sort of thought, oh, that's interesting, because it was something I'd always wanted to do, but had been pushed to one side. I'd actually also suffered from depression And I smoked heavily. I'd actually been in the mental hospital for 6 weeks with fairly severe depression before I got married. And I think at that stage still taking tablets as it happens. And this couple of people sort of said, oh, you know, sort of come and join us. And I bought a camera, a very cheap one, although I had had a camera before. And I actually set up a hide and photographed a wren at its nest, the first thing I ever did. And within 3 weeks, I'd stopped smoking and stopped taking antidepressants. And it just sort of developed from there. I haven't got those photographs now. I wish I'd kept them, actually. I mean, they were ghastly, but at the time, I thought they were wonderful. It started with birds, and then gradually, like other things, you know, you realise there's more to life and the natural world than birds. So now anything that is anything connected with the natural world, I'll photograph. And in recent years, well, since I retired, took a very early retirement to 51, I've travelled the world, basically, the Galapagos, Falklands, Australia, got just back from Borneo 4 weeks ago, been to Africa several times. And it's, say, something I wanted to do from this age, basically, you know, from a youngster, was slapped around the face and told, no, you can't do that, it's ridiculous, which in those days you probably couldn't, you know, you go to be a good lad, you do your exams, you go to college and you become a teacher. Which I thoroughly enjoyed, not latterly, but to begin with, it was an incredible job. But as the politicians got involved, yeah, Fred, it got me down all the paperwork, so that's why I got out very early.
And you travel do you travel specifically to take photographs?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I don't see any other reason for going abroad. My wife comes with me now because she retired at Christmas. A lot of trips I've been, you know, with other people on tours. Now my wife's retired, we don't have to stick to some, you know, school holidays. But each summer we used to go somewhere on our own. I mean, we've been to Seychelles on our own, we've done South Africa on our own, been to Alaska and British Columbia, been to America several times on our own as well. We just organised, you know, get a car, went to Costa Rica 2 years on our own. But I have a mixture. This year we went to Florida on our own to do bird photography in the spring. Then in June went to Italy with a photographic tour to photograph butterflies and flowers. Borneo was again a photographic trip, sort of doing all sorts of things from frogs and snakes to monkeys and orangutans. And then we're going to Madagascar, where I've been before actually. Again, that's a photographic tour. My wife doesn't take photographs, but she just likes to be in wild places. She wanders around while we're busy taking pictures, sort of thing.
And what do you do with the pictures?
I do lots of slideshows, sort of travel all over the country, talk to RSPB groups. Earlier this week I was in Grimsby doing a talk for them. But I'm in Carlisle in December, I'm in the Wirral in a couple of weeks' time doing talks, so I travel quite widely doing talks. And in recent years I've actually lodged photographs with an agency in London who sell on my behalf. So I don't make a fortune at it, but I cover some of the costs. I mean, I don't make any profits, but by doing that, as I'm now on a pension, it sort of supplements my pension, and I say it covers at least the cost of you know, the film, and goes towards maybe the odd trip here and there, but it's not something you make a lot of money at.
Can I ask you about something you mentioned right at the beginning of that section? You said you built a hide.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how you do that?
Well, you buy commercial ones. Basically, it's a canvas tent. They stand about 3.5 foot high. I suppose that should be a metre, shouldn't it, nowadays? Metre square, with four corners and guy ropes. And you have a little tunnel at the front through which a camera lens points. And you've got a little peephole with netting over it so things can't see in, but you can see out. And you position that with a ground nesting bird. You'll put it up in a position away from where the nest photographer, which again nowadays isn't done so much, but you'd put it up, check the bird came back the nest and gradually move it nearer until you're in a position where you could actually take photographs. Occasionally you have to build them on a pylon if you're doing, you know, owls, which is one of my favourite things. So you have a pylon and gradually build that over a period of days or weeks and have the hide on top of that again. So you can actually see the bird, but it doesn't actually see you, and you can then photograph it.
What's a pylon?
A scaffolding tower, if you like, yeah. So you can get square scaffolding towers, again, something like about a metre and a half square, you erect them, and you build that up gradually next to where the nest is. put a platform, again you move that up gradually and then build a hide gradually on top of that, so you're actually overlooking the nest for photography. And in the case of owls you use flash guns obviously because they're nocturnal. So,
and have you always used these commercially produced hides?
No, I've produced them myself. I mean, it's very simple, just sort of four corner poles and canvas over the top basically. I mean, I don't do that. I mean, that's mainly for nest photography. Although I have used them in the garden, for example, with baiting, you know, putting bird food out with a nice natural perch. And you sit in there and the birds come down and you photograph them on the perch rather than on the bird table or whatever. But a lot of nowadays, with longer lenses, you know, you will photograph, particularly abroad, things are so approachable you don't need a hide. But there are lots of hides on reserves now, you know, RSPB Trust Reserves, where you can actually photograph things from big sort of wooden built hides. So don't use the portal ones as much as you used to do.
Can I ask you now about the Lincolnshire Wildlife Trust and your association with it?
Yeah.
Could you tell me, perhaps we ought to start with your actual connection with it, how you became involved with it?
Well, initially Joe, I think, persuaded me to join. I can't remember exactly when, but it was around sort of late teens, early 20s. And I wasn't then involved till approximately 30 years ago, and sort of my wife was back at work, had a little more time, and we started going looking at nature reserves, and I sort of met Joe again because I'd been in absence when I hadn't seen him, and the reserve manager Frank Brazier at Epworth Turbine wanted to give it up, and Joe sort of somehow arranged a meeting where I was going to be there as well, and I just started doing photography. And said, would you like to be reserve manager here? And I mean, you know, the dream come true. I said, yeah, sure. So he recommended me to the trust, and I basically became reserve manager at Epworth Turbury. And Frank, the previous manager, had started doing management work there by removing trees, because Epworth Turbury is a relic of a raised bog. And the trees moved in towards the beginning of the last century, about the time of the First World War. Before then, it was completely treeless. When the drains were deepened in the late 50s, early 60s, it dried out more and the trees took over. And so we lost a lot of the habitat that used to be there, the heather and what have you, shaded out by the trees. So I really carried on where Frank had left off, sort of increasing the open areas to get it back to what it was like when, in fact, when I first went there in the 50s, the trees weren't anything like as extensive. So that's sort of the involvement. And from there, at the same time the area group was set up, because the Lincolnshire Wildlife Trust has area groups, I think at the moment we've got 17 in various parts of the county, where they have a chairman, secretary and a committee, and they put on a series of programmes for that particular part of the county. And we set up a group in the Isle of Axholme, and I ended up as chairman. So that was that. And then with reorganisation of Humberside, We you know, Lincolnshire was got a, the northern part was turned into Humberside. We had a group called the Humberside Liaison Group, which was the Isle Group, the Scunthorpe Group, the Barton and Humber Group, and the Grimsby Group. And we used to have meetings to sort of, because we'd been separated, if you like, from Lincolnshire, we're still part of the Lincolnshire Wildlife Trust. And as a result of that, I, to my amazement, got onto the council of the Trust. And after being on there for a few years and discovering what it was all about, because to begin with it was, you know, what on earth's going on here, I became a member of the board. So my involvement now is the reserve manager, which I think probably is the most important thing in some ways. I'm chairman of the area group, which is very much a social as well as a, it's not altogether a natural history group. You know, we have lots of social events as well. I'm a board member, and then I'm also involved with the Heathland team, which I'm convener of. You know, I have meetings on reserves and management and what have you. The Grassland team and the publications team, because we do a Lapwings magazine three times a year. I'm sort of, you know, pretty well involved in all sorts of branches of the Trust now.
You told me earlier about how you knew about the level of tree growth on Epworth Turbury.
Yeah.
You said you spoke to someone who confirmed what you know about it.
Yeah, I gave a talk a long time ago, probably a very bad talk, actually. I hope I've improved since those early days. In Scunthorpe, there was a lady in the audience who I think was in her late 70s then. We're talking 20-odd years ago, at least. might have been in her early 80s, and she said, oh, you brought back so many memories, Mr. Trent, because I've talked about Epworth Turbary, among other places in the Isle of Axholme, because she said, I used to live on the farm just north of Epworth Turbary, just before the First World War and towards 1920. And as a child, I wasn't allowed on there on my own because it was so wet you could actually sink into the bog. And there were no trees, although one or two trees got established at that stage in the northwest corner, which is slightly higher than the rest of the reserve. And in those days, she said, it was covered in sphagnum moss and also... various species of orchid, probably southern marsh orchid, and also sundew, which is the insectivorous eating plant. Those have all disappeared now. There was also things like bog rosemary, which used to grow there at its most southern point in eastern England. And also, before the trees got established, it was the most southern point where large heath butterflies occurred. And again, they're now extinct because of the tree growth. We tried a reintroduction programme, which wasn't successful. So it's you know, quite a unique site. There are many things that occurred there at the most southern point in on the eastern side of England anyway. So that's how I knew there weren't many trees there. And then when I went in the 50s, what is now the main open area, the tree growth there was sort of no more than sort of 4 or 5 foot high. And it was when the drain was deepened that obviously it dried out even more and the trees then just accelerated. Mainly birch initially, which is a pioneering species, and is a short-lived tree, only lives for about 80 years. But what happens is the birch comes as scrub. Then you get birds moving in like jays to breed. They go out in autumn, collect acorns in their crop. They come back to the breeding woods. They'll bury some of the acorns for use later in the winter and forget where some of them are. So the birch is growing up. The acorns have been brought in and buried. Some of those will germinate, an oak starts to grow, protected by the birch trees. Eventually the oak grows up, the birch dies out, and the oak takes over. So natural succession, if you left the area entirely alone, it would more or less become an oak woodland. And of course that's not what is important for it. It is a relic of a raised bog, and it has sort of, you know, plants, animals on there which are unique to that sort of habitat, and that sort of habitat is very rare. Just as, I mean, very similar to Crowell and Thorn, which I'm going to talk about a bit later. But that's all part of the relic of what was once the whole Isle of Axholme, you know, a landscape which is now more or less disappeared.
So how would the precious landscape, if you like, and flora and fauna be affected by this growth in a different environment?
Well, it creates shade to start with, and many things like heather will not grow under trees, so that will disappear. And you've got heather that grows in wet areas, cross-leaved heath. You've got the ordinary heather which grows on the drier areas. Tree cover will gradually shade that out and you will lose it. And obviously there's animals associated with certain plants, and if the plants disappear, then the animals disappear. Bog rosemary, which sadly is not on there anymore, again, disappeared probably due to the drought in the sort of 80s, early 90s. It occurred on there till, I'm not sure when the last record was, I think it was about 1981. But we had a very dry period, and the Turbary got even drier than normal. And it was hanging on very, you know, precariously, and the drought was what finished it off. So a combination of again, trees shade areas out, they probably accelerate the drying out to a certain extent as well. And that is detrimental to the natural flora you get on there, and obviously the fauna which depends on it.
Can I ask you a bit about the Lincolnshire Wildlife Trust itself for a minute? Can you tell me about the Lincolnshire Wildlife Trust, what it's set out for, what its objectives are, and what it sees its role as?
Well, it's one of many trusts that cover the whole of the British Isles. And basically they've sort of, very forward thinking actually, the Lincolnshire Trust was the third one to be set up, the Norfolk Trust was the first, then the Yorkshire Trust, and then the Lincolnshire Trust. And very far-sighted people realise that the natural world and the plants and animals, which were part of the natural part of the British Isles, was under threat. I mean, if you think about the war, you know, dig for victory. It was essential that land was turned over to produce food and all the rest of it. So habitats which had been common and, you know, everyone just accepted they were there, began to disappear. And as they disappeared, so the plant and animal communities that you found on them also disappeared. And the trusts were really set up to sort of try and halt that decline and, where possible, purchase sites that are of value natural history wise so that these species were conserved, really for future generations. And also, you know, nowadays it's called biodiversity. I think it is important that we have as much diversity on the planet, not just in England, but worldwide, as we can, because we're part of that. And if we destroy all the biodiversity, and if initially we're going to we're going to destroy ourselves. So it was very small beginnings, saving, you know, people in those days who thought the natural world was important, set up these organisations to try and conserve areas which were under threat.
And what do you mean by conservation? Do you mean you just sort of he bought a piece of land, fenced it off and left it?
Well, in the early days, I mean, I think the first year the Lancashire Trust was set up, their income spreadsheet for the year was something like about £90 coming in and going out. I mean, we're now talking about millions in a year. So, yes, initially, really, there were very few people. I think it was 60 members initially. Very little funds. So if you could buy a site so it wasn't developed in any way, that was the most important thing. At least it was going to stay more or less as it was. But as we acquired more sites, there is this natural succession I mentioned on Epworth, the trees moving in. Well, that's the same with every site. So if you want to maintain its interest, you have to manage it. And it's only as the trust grew and grants became available through people like English Nature that funds were available to manage them. So in the initial stage, it was a case of buying these places so they weren't destroyed, and then as funds became available, we've sort of gradually developed techniques, not just our trust, but all the trusts, the RSPB and other conservation bodies, in the best way to manage them, to conserve and maintain the diversity of plants and animals that were there, which the site was bought for in the first place.
Now, bearing in mind this is a history of Thorn and Hatfield Moors, and we're talking about Thorn Moors in this case,
yeah.
What are the areas of the Lincolnshire Wildlife Trust that come within that remit?
Well, Crowell Waste, which is part of the Thorn, I mean, it's all part of the NNR now, the Humhead Levels NNR. And the Trust were the first conservation group, I think, which actually owned any of the whole complex. We approached Fysons. I'm not sure the exact date, but, you know, going back possibly as long as 35, 40 years ago. And initially we had a lease on parts of it from Fysons and were the first conservation body to do that. Then gradually over the years we've purchased bits. And I think because of the way we approached Fysons, we weren't sort of extreme in any way, they looked favourably on other...